And tonight we have the awesome Chris.
Excellent. Everybody, my name's Chris. I'm an alcoholic. A couple of things. This group is looking for a couple of volunteers. One of them is we need a secretary. We've been without a secretary for a couple months now. Our secretary went AWOL. It's not a real serious commitment. I think you have to read some of the general announcements that come in the mail and things like that. Another thing is we could use a coffee maker. If anybody wants to, say, do it for 3 or 4 months, that'd be a great idea. Fran has been kind enough to be doing it for at least 6 months or more now, and we certainly appreciate it, but it's about time for her to move on with her commitment. Yes? Oh, excellent. Okay. Thank you, Melissa. Okay, thanks. There we go. Another issue is last week, if you can imagine, we forgot to pass the basket. And we lost our opportunity for $100 or so. So if it suits your purposes and you were here last week, double basket for us. We do have our expenses and we admit to being boneheads about that. Okay, like I said, my name is Chris. I am an alcoholic. Oh, Mary Beth's got a big bucket back there. That's optimistic. For anybody that's new, hasn't been to this meeting before, we're repeating a workshop that Peter M. and I did last February at the Wilson House up in East Dorset, Vermont. And it was just a simple big book study. And each of us talks on three steps, alternating weeks. So I believe next week Peter will be speaking on 4, 5, and 6. And tonight I'm speaking on the first three steps. I believe very strongly that the first step is probably the most misunderstood step in Alcoholics Anonymous or any 12-step fellowship. Inherent in the illness of alcoholism is an almost utter inability to cognitively understand how much trouble you're really in. Part of the addictive illness is not being able to see clearly the totality of your problem. There's a lot of information in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, and I highly recommend not only reading the big book, but studying it and following its suggestions. Where it says to do something, do it. Where it says to write something, write it. Where it says to go out and handle some relationship issue, go out and do that. Because so much of Alcoholics Anonymous is experiential. It's not a theory, it's a way of life. So to truly get the benefits of the 12-step experience, you need to experience it. Talking about it and going to meetings and listening to it and, you know, reading about it, listening to tapes and discussing it is not really the way to get the experience. Actually doing it is the way to get the experience. But anyway, I'll include myself as one of the people who don't know how much trouble they're in. I'm sure if I could really 100% accurately assess my problem with alcoholism, I'd be doing more than I'm doing now. I'd probably be going to more meetings. I probably would be working with more people. I probably would be paying more attention. It's, again, inherent in the illness is an inability to truly see what your problem is. Another thing that I did for many, many years is my ego wanted to take credit for any problems or successes in my life. My ego wanted to take credit for it. When I started coming to meetings, I would say, well, I'm going to all these meetings, you know, and I'm working the steps, so, you know, I'm working on my sobriety and I'm staying sober because of what I'm doing. My ego wanted to always take credit for it. You see it a lot with people who relapse. They'll come back and they'll say, I relapsed because I did so-and-so, or I made the decision to pick up the first drink. These are all manifestations of our ego wanting to take credit for our successes or our failures where it concerns alcoholism or addictive illness. Everything I've learned from the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous that I could relate directly to my own personal experience leads me to believe that lack of power is my dilemma. Lack of power. Not lack of knowledge. Not lack of meetings. Not lack of sponsorship. But lack of power is my dilemma. And to admit to powerlessness over alcohol, certain things have to be operative for an accurate admission for powerlessness. To be powerless over something is to have no power over it, okay? If you say, well, if I go to enough meetings, you know, I'll stay sober, then you're admitting that you have the power over alcoholism. If you just go to enough meetings, you'll stay sober. I made a mistake of thinking if I went to enough meetings and I worked the steps with a sponsor, I'll be able to stay sober. And again, my ego wants me to believe that there's something I can do to recover from alcoholism. There's something I can do to prevent the first drink. And I got to a point where today I believe that consistent meeting attendance, working and reworking the steps with a sponsor or a spiritual advisor, going for a deeper experience each time I do so, and working with other alcoholics, what that'll do is that'll place me in the spiritual atmosphere where my higher power can relieve me of my obsession to drink and solve my problems. I have to participate in my recovery, obviously, but I have to let go of the fact that I have to let go of that ego drive that wants me to believe I'm the one in charge of this whole process. I don't even have the power to go to meetings consistently. I don't even have the power to get through the steps. I don't have the power to work with other people without God's help. I just don't. So where is my power? My power is pretty much non-existent. A true understanding of your own personal truth is very, very important in Alcoholics Anonymous or any of the other 12-step fellowships. If you don't come to the concession, the innermost admission of your powerlessness, you will probably burn out in AA. You'll probably not go through the steps. You'll probably not sponsor. You'll probably somewhere along the line stop going to meetings. I have seen in the last couple of weeks, I've seen some amazing things. I've seen some people with real serious time go back out. Really serious time go back out. There's an individual who will go nameless who's from this county who had well over 20 years and at least two meetings a day. Now, if you had 20 years and were going to meetings twice a day, wouldn't you think you could stay sober? I would think so. I mean, that's what I was led to believe early on in AA. Meeting makers make it, right? Isn't that what they told you? Well, this is a beautiful example of a meeting maker not making it. Just not making it. So I have to let go of a lot of conceptions and a lot of the things that I was led to believe early on in AA to get to a true understanding of the first step. I like to break the first step down into three parts. The first part is the allergy of the body. That's pretty easy for me. What the allergy of the body basically is when alcohol is put into my system, I get a craving. I get a physical craving. It's a phenomenon that I don't even fight. I mean, my alcoholism has progressed to the point where I don't even fight it. I start drinking and I get drunk. I continue to drink as long as there's alcohol there or I have a way to get to the alcohol. The first drink always asks for the second drink. The second drink always demands the third drink. The third drink always completely insists on the fourth drink, etc., etc., until I'm tongue-chewing, knee-walking, passing out wherever the hell I am, drunk. You ever been knee-walking drunk? I'll tell you, you know, not many people but alcoholics get that bad. I mean, you're still out there. You're walking on your knees and you're still going. People don't understand that when they see us do that three nights in a row. Anyway, that's what happens to me. That's my experience. I can't argue with that. Can't argue with that. Now, is that everybody's experience who can identify as an alcoholic? No, I don't believe so. I have heard, now I don't know this from personal experience, but I've heard it from other people, that every time they drank, they didn't get completely drunk. But there were times when they were not planning on getting drunk and they got drunk. Okay? You go out to have two at the bar, you end up closing the place, going to the city, not showing up for work for 3 days. I mean, does that happen every time? Maybe not. But the fact of the matter is you have to ask yourself, do you have control over how much you drink? Can you moderate every single time that you pick up alcohol? Most of us have to say no. And if you can moderate every time you pick up alcohol, you're really not what the book Alcoholics Anonymous would say is an alcoholic. You know, you were probably a heavy drinker or whatever that they describe in here. If you can control, once you start drinking, you can control how much you drink every single time. But I'm telling you, not many people end up in the rooms of AA who can. Because why don't you if you can? Again, a lot of times I do a lot of speaking in rehabs, a lot. And a lot of people want to tell me in rehabs that every single time they got drunk, they chose to get drunk. And, you know, all I have to do is decide not to get drunk and I'll be fine. And I think we all know that's usually erroneous. They're usually back flat on their ass somehow or other in a very short period of time, wondering what happened. So the allergy of the body, the phenomenon of craving, that needs to be operative for powerlessness over alcohol, for that admission. The second thing that you need is an obsession in the mind. Now, here's where our mind will play a lot of tricks on us. Again, the ego wants you to think it's your choice when you pick up a drink. It's your choice. But I've got to tell you, here's the theory that the book Alcoholics Anonymous puts forward. If you're alcoholic and you pick up a drink, you're in a strange mental blank spot. You're in you have a subtle form of insanity that manifests itself in your mind, because I'm telling you, if you're an alcoholic and you pick up a drink, that is an insane act. Knowing what happens to us, we can come to in Topeka with one shoe, with a summons for a DWI, not knowing what happened. I mean, you know, think about some of the crazy things that's happened, you know? You can wake up in bed with ET or something. I mean, you know some of the things that can happen. I mean, just horrifying things. I'm never doing that again. I'm never doing that again. You know, 2 weeks later, you're doing it again. That's the obsession of the mind. Now, again, I want to say this again because it really is important. Your ego wants you to believe you're the one running the show. Okay? When an alcoholic picks up a drink, it's because they're insane. I sponsor a guy who's going to be getting out of prison in the next year. Here's what he did. He decided that his alcoholism had got his attention. And he was going to go into Carrier Clinic, okay? He's going in. You know how we do that? We're going in. But he wanted a drink for the ride because he lived way up north. And, you know, it was about an hour and a half ride to Carrier Clinic. So he made a giant vodka something or other and put it between his legs, buckled up, and took off for Carrier. Now, This is a very tragic thing happened to him. The great road that goes down to Carrier Clinic, if anybody's familiar with that, it's a long road, about 50, 55 miles an hour. And he's going down there toward Carrier. a nurse, it's her first day on the job at Carrier, is leaving. Her shift is over. She's pulling out onto the great road. She's coming this way. He's going that way. He's drunk. He crosses the double yellow. He head-ons her, and he kills her. Kills the nurse, okay? He's okay. Now, comes time for his trial. And he got hooked in with a lawyer who, you know, was just feeding him a line. He absolutely should have pled, okay? How guilty are you? He absolutely should have pled, but he allowed a lawyer to talk him into going for the insanity plea and spending $100,000 on going for the insanity plea. Now, here's what I learned about the insanity plea from sitting through this trial. If you want to go for the insanity plea, you have to prove that you did not know right from wrong. You didn't know what you were doing was wrong. There's something that does not allow your mind to understand that what you did was wrong. You were suffering from insanity. That's the insanity defense. Okay? Not knowing right from wrong. Now, he was found guilty because he buckled up for safety. And he was heading for a rehab. He knew that his alcoholism was causing him problems. So he was found guilty. They assumed that he did know right from wrong. Here's what I'm saying. When we pick up a drink, they say it's because we fell short on our spiritual life. We failed to broaden and deepen our spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others. We stopped participating in our spiritual life. That's usually what we've done wrong. But we don't choose to pick up a drink, no matter what our mind tells us. It's completely, if I pick up a drink, here's what I would have to do. I would have to walk into a bar and sit down, and here's what I'd tell the bartender if I was in a sane state of mind. Bartender, I'm about to order a drink, and I just need to let you know what happened the last time I started drinking. Last time I started drinking, I went into a three-day blackout. I threatened my entire family with a .38 caliber handgun. I came to, and I went into the delirium tremens for 3 days, where I was hallucinating and seeing demons, and there was animals running around. I thought I was going to die. My heart was beating out of my chest. I somehow got up the fortitude to make it to an AA meeting, and for the next 8 months I struggled just to continue to be able to go to AA meetings so that I could survive, and somehow I made it, and I was able to get sober, and alcohol didn't kill me. Could I have a double? Do you understand what I'm saying? But that's not how we go to the bar. We don't go to the bar in a sane state of mind. We go to the bar in an insane state of mind, not knowing right from wrong, not fully comprehending the enormity of the mistake it will be to put alcohol back in our body. That's why 95% of us die. 95% of the, you know, statistics are bogus, erroneous, and I'll never ever swear to anything near accuracy with them. But I've heard this, that there are 300 million alcoholics on this planet. And they figured that out just by how many people in a population are alcoholics. So there's 300 million alcoholics on the planet. There's 2 million sober alcoholics in AA at the last census. The last census that tries to census anonymous people. But do you understand, even if they're off by 30%, those figures, that really says something. It says that you have about a 2% chance of survival if you're an alcoholic. You have about a 2% chance of getting and staying sober where anybody can tell you're doing something. So that's really not great. You know what I mean? It's really not the best odds. I believe that way more than most of us die alcoholic deaths. And we go out in some really, really ugly ways. How many in here have buried people that they know from the fellowship or from your family from alcoholism? I mean, yeah, come on. And it's not pretty, is it? It's always a horrific set of circumstances. You know, we do not die heading up a Red Cross charity drive. You know what I mean? We do not expire from alcoholism, singing in the church choir. I mean, you know, we are usually at the worst possible place in our life, the most pathetic. We've ruined every single relationship we have. People either resent us or pity us. That's how we usually check out. So why would an alcoholic pick up the first drink if they were in the same state of mind? So the obsession of the mind is alcoholism doesn't care why you drink, why you need to drink. I used to think alcoholic consumption was causal. What I mean by that is, I used to believe that because my life sucked so bad is why I drank. Because my wife left me. Because I've got a terrible job. Because all my relationships are just, you know, nobody seems to understand me and everybody's judgmental. And I just, bad breaks and misunderstandings just follow me everywhere. And that's why I thought, let me ask this, and you don't have to raise your hand, but just answer to yourself. Did you ever drink when you lost a job? Did you ever drink when you got a good job? Did you ever drink when the sun was shining? Did you ever drink when it was raining? Did you ever drink when you were sick, when you were feeling really bad? Did you ever drink when you were feeling really good? You see where I'm going with this? What the hell does alcohol care how you feel? What the hell does alcohol care about exterior circumstances? Alcoholism doesn't care about exterior circumstances. All it'll do is compound the misery of those external circumstances. Or even this, temporarily give you a little bit of reprieve. You know, between drink 4 and drink 7 before you become a puking pig. You'll start to feel a little bit better. You know what I mean? So you have a brain that's going to force you back into drinking. There's no defense against the first drink. It says right in here in our book on page 24. The fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. We can't choose to drink or not drink. We can't choose to stop drinking once we start. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We are unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. So much for keeping your memory green, right? Listen, I lecture and I bring meetings into rehabs all over the place. And I'm even asked every once in a while to speak to graduating master's classes for people that are becoming social workers or alcoholism counselors. And I've got to tell you, a lot of the things that you're told are not true. Keep your memory green. Now, if they were to say, it's always good to keep your memory green so that, you know, you need to always understand that you don't want to ever drink again, that's fine. But you can't do that, the book is telling us. So it's good to do, just understand that you can't do it. You can't keep your memory green. Is it a good thing to keep your memory green? Yes. Can you do it? No. All right. It's not a defense against the first drink. A lot of things are not a defense against the first drink. This book talks about suddenly. It talks about what? I think the guy's name is Jim. He's selling cars and he stops into this place to have a sandwich and a glass of milk. And he's sitting there and he decides he'll have another sandwich and another glass of milk, but this time he'll put whiskey in it. He'd been to the asylum for drinking. He'd been to the asylum for drinking. When you get out of an asylum, you want to stay the hell out of an asylum. You know what I'm saying? If you have anything up here going on, you don't want to go back to the asylum. Well, he starts putting whiskey in milk, thinking that it won't hurt him. Suddenly, the thought crosses his mind that a little whiskey and milk will not hurt him. Suddenly does not allow you the opportunity to call your sponsor. Suddenly does not allow you the time to pick up a coffee commitment. Suddenly does not allow you time to pick up your meetings. Get to a bunch more meetings. You know, fill up the well. Suddenly doesn't leave you shit. Suddenly you're done. Suddenly happens. You're drinking. And then you're pounding on the bar, wondering why that, what the hell happened? Anybody here ever pound on the bar? You go back out drinking, and you're like, oh my God, I'm drinking again. What the hell am I doing? That's the obsession of the mind. The obsession of the mind does not care that drinking is a bad idea for you. Alcoholism, that's what it is. Alcoholism wants you drinking, wants you to die. So if I've got a mind that's going to bring me back to alcohol, and I don't have a defense against the first drink, that's a death sentence. That's Custer's last stand, and there's more Indians coming over the hill. You know what I mean? You're in trouble. You're in trouble. Now, there's another example in this book that certain people can stay away from alcohol for long periods of time. But the time and the place comes when alcohol goes back in your body. I've heard the story about many people who've backed away from AA, and it's taken 2, 4, 6 years for them to start drinking again. But because they fell short on their spiritual life, they started drinking or they started using drugs again. Something to get away from that emotional and psychic pain that alcoholism causes. And that brings me into part three of step one. You know, there's a couple of good examples, but page 52 is a great example of dash that our lives have become unmanageable. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, dash that our lives have become unmanageable. And I've heard that dash in literature is the same as an equal sign in math. There's really not any differentiation. It's part of the same idea. So powerlessness over alcohol, unmanageable life, is all part and parcel of my problem, my alcoholism. Here's a way unmanageability can manifest itself in an alcoholic not drinking. I'm talking about not drinking. We can stay away from alcohol for short periods of time. Ask yourself this. Ask yourself if any of these things are current within you right now, or they're your experience in between the drinks. We were having trouble with our personal relationships. Guilty. We couldn't control our emotional nature. If you were depressed, could you become undepressed? If you were resentful, could you just snap your fingers and have that resentment disappear for good and for all? Did you have guilt and remorse over the things that were that happened to you in your past and where you fell short with the people you cared about? Because alcoholism will force you to fall short. You're going to fall short. And I'll tell you, we're sensitive people. We don't want to fall short. I don't know any alcoholic that's pathologically evil. I've never met one. I've met evil people in AA, but usually they're in here for an agenda. They're not in here because they're alcoholic. They're in here for some predatorial crap that they're involved with or looking for. I've never met an evil alcoholic. We do evil things, but we're not evil people. We're usually smart people that do stupid things, and good people that do bad things. That's usually the way it is. We want to be judged on our intentions. You know, it's inconvenient that we get judged on our actions. That doesn't seem fair to us. You know, I didn't mean to, like, you know, run over your dog and park in your pool last night. It's not. I didn't mean to do that. It's an accident. But we were prey to misery and depression. You remember the misery and the depression in between the drinks? Do you have misery and depression today? Have you gone through the steps? You know, have you gone through the steps? Because the steps, if you look at the 9-step promises, they're the antidote to this. Get through the first 9 steps to the best of your ability, fearlessly and thoroughly. And a lot of this stuff goes away, or at least becomes manageable. We couldn't make a living, and I don't believe that means money. I know most alcoholics make more money while they're out there drinking than they do once they get sober. A lot of times they get so spiritual they don't really feel like putting in those 12-hour days anymore. You know what I mean? I got praying, and I want to go to the meetings, you know, and watch the sunset. And that's actually a good thing. It really is. It's actually a good thing. I sponsor a lot of guys that make shitloads of money. They're like, you know, Wall Street guys and stuff. And I warn them right up front, you know. Understand that the spiritual life, you're going to probably drop some of your intensity on that. You know, you're probably going to start making less money. So I just kind of warn them. But you'll be much happier. We had a feeling of uselessness. We were full of fear. Remember that fear, and it doesn't necessarily manifest itself like your cowardly fear. It manifests itself like that anxiety, that just being uncomfortable with yourself and your environment. You just don't want to step out. You don't want to go to motor vehicle. You don't want to go shopping. You don't want to do anything because it's just more comfortable to stay home and watch Slipovision all night long. You know what I mean? Watch Seinfeld reruns or something. It's just easier. You don't have to deal. You got like a lack of dealing as an untreated alcoholic. You know what I'm saying? You've got to know what I'm talking about because it's a disease of isolation. And the reason you're isolating is because of fear, that self-centered fear. You just want a smaller and smaller life. You don't want to deal. You know, you don't want to be out there doing all kinds of stuff. It's just too uncomfortable. We couldn't seem to be a real help to other people. I always wanted to be helpful to other people. You know, I'd give you great advice sitting at the bar. I knew everything sitting at the bar, you know. You could be a brain surgeon and I'd give you some pointers, you know. A brain surgery. It's just unbelievable. I always wanted to be helpful to other people as long as it didn't inconvenience me. This is the first step. Unmanageable life. Now this is a there's other forms of unmanageability. If you want to go to the first couple of pages of Vision for You, it talks about the hideous four horsemen: terror, frustration, bewilderment, and despair. It talks about real acute alcoholism. It talks about the jumping off point. That's a manifestation of the unmanageability at the acute level. You know, that's right before we pull the trigger and blow our brains out. Here's a nice statistic for you. The alcoholic is 60 times more likely to take their own life than the non-alcoholic. Why do you think if you put down alcoholic on page one of your life insurance, it bollocks the whole deal up? Because they know. They know you're a bad risk. I'm not insured. The actuators just flip out. You know, their computers start, red flashing lights go off. Alcoholic. He's probably going to kill himself. I mean, everybody knows it but us. Okay, so, you know, I'm not telling you to not put alcoholism down on your life insurance policy. God forbid I would tell you to do something unethical like not tell the truth. But either you want life insurance or you don't. You know, I will say that. Somebody told me to be honest. You got to be honest everywhere. And I was honest in my first couple of months of sobriety, and I had to get myself life insurance because I had to cover my daughter. I had to get a family plan going. And I put down alcoholic just out of a treatment center, blah, blah, blah. They put me on a 2-year limited benefit thing. And what that was I get no benefits no matter what happens to me for 2 years, but I got to pay anyway. That was my insurance policy. That was beautiful. It was like $800 a month for like nothing. You know what I mean? Because they would have said pre-existing illness. He's an alcoholic. Anything can happen to an alcoholic, pre-existing. So this is the first step, okay? None of us can fully manifest that understanding 100%. It says in the step book, in step one, who among us wishes to admit complete defeat? Nobody wants to admit complete defeat like that. That's like saying, I'm dead, there's nothing I can do, I'm dead. Nobody wants to admit defeat like that. Good thing there's a second step. The second step moves us toward a solution to the first step. First step's a problem step, the second step is a solution step. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. I remember hearing that sanity in the second step and being highly offended. Because I don't know anybody else in here, but I was burdened with a very, very strong mind when I came in here. It was a cross to bear being so much smarter than everybody, and, you know, so more acutely aware of like injustice and hypocrisy. You know, I was like, I had this like dark, complicated, artistic perspective on everything. It was just really difficult to be me. You know, there was a couple of other people that had existed in the past that. had the same problem, and their fuse usually burn out pretty quick too. But you know, I mean, and this was my understanding of myself. I mean, how ridiculous! I was just suffering from delusion and insanity. I took it to be genius. You know, what are you gonna do? My sponsor corrected me pretty quickly on that. You know? Some of those early sponsor lessons were tough cross to bear. Anyway. What kind of sanity are they talking about in the second step? We're not, you know, some of us are crazy, some of us are, but most of us aren't. We're strangely insane when it comes to alcohol or drugs. That's where we're strangely insane. We're usually okay in other areas. Now, you know, many of us have problems other than alcohol. That's really the only thing this book says about it is go to some serious professionals. You know, if you've got problems other than alcohol, seek out some professionals. And what I would say is seek out professionals that understand addictive illnesses, because they're few and far between the ones that aren't going to misdiagnose you with some crap. You know, a good for instance is if you just come off the firing line, you're an alcoholic, you just come off the firing line, you've lost your family, your job, you got a DWI, you know you're heading for the court system. You're physically really sick. You come into AA. You're spinning dry. And you know what symptoms aren't you gonna have for psychological problems? Okay, you know you're gonna be across the board. They're gonna be able to label your ass. So go to somebody who understands addictive illnesses, please. Anyway, the second step. The insanity, where it concerns, why do we pick back up when it's the stupidest thing in the world for us to do? Why do we do that? Why do we have a mind that convinces us it's okay to pick it back up? Or, you know, the hell with those AA people, you know, this isn't working for me. I'll be able to, you know, I'm just going to buy half pints from now on. Or, you know, I'm going to just do, I did schnapps one time. I said, I'm off of the vodka, I'm just drinking schnapps. How much schnapps can you drink? Let me tell you, it gets messy drinking schnapps the way I drank it. That's all I'm going to say. I mean, it got to the point in my drinking, I didn't have the energy to get up from my desk and walk 30 feet to the bathroom anymore. I'd just throw open the window and I'd vomit out the window. And there was sidewalks with right next to a retirement community. And people would be, you know, walking by, you know, it was so bad. In the wintertime, the gutter would fill up with frozen vomit. I mean, I'm telling you, it was a mess. And yeah, and I was wondering where all the babes were. You know what I mean? Like, you know, what a happening guy like me. Why aren't I being discovered? But this is all, you know, I don't mean to gross anybody out. I'm just saying that this just seemed like a normal way to live to me. I mean, you know, where it concerns alcoholism, we're strangely insane. Now, a power greater than ourselves restoring us to sanity. That brings us to the concept of God, okay? Has anybody in here, when they came into AA, had a little bit of problem with organized religion or religious concepts? No. I got sober during the Jim and Tammy Faye Baker era when they were selling more heaven condos than there actually were. And Jimmy Swaggart was telling everybody they're a sinner and getting caught in the motels with the hookers and stuff. Okay, and these were God's front end men. These were part of the front four of God's team, and they were falling short in a big way. They were falling short more than I was falling short. At least I wasn't ripping off, you know, the elderly or engaging in solicitation of prostitution, for God's sake. I'm better than them. So I had a lot of problems with organized religions and God concept. This was my concept of God. Up there on top of the clouds, sitting on a desk with St. Peter with a big ledger. You know, that Schroeder kid just did this, that Schroeder kid just did that. You know, listen it all down, because when judgment day comes, I'm going to be standing in front of him like the local judge who took my license away three times. You know what I mean? Well, you know, it wasn't really my fault. Like he's some like you know, divine being who's going to, well, I'm going to give you 40,000 years in purgatory and then make, you know, one of these type of deities, okay? A judgmental Old Testament, poke your eye out with a stick, turn your wife into salt, locusts all over your ass, you know, and flood your lands, you know, have bears eat your children type of Old Testament God. It didn't work real well for turning my will and my life over to. I gotta tell you. And he was like another aspect. I believe he was like a cosmic Alan Funt, because I believe, you know, like if this God was omnipotent, then he's moving me around like a pawn. And, oh, let's make Chris get really high on Quaaludes and drive to the police station and ask for directions. You know, this will be great. And I mean, because I was doing these insane, stupid things, and oh my God, some of the things that I did, I'm not even gonna get into them. But listen, I'll tell you this one story. I'm getting my driver's license back from a third DWI. Okay, when I lost my license, I figured I'd be walking until there were jets and mobiles flying around. You know, and this really put a crimp in my dating life too, because, you know, you have to tell them that the Mercedes is in the shop, you know, and you got to come get me. It was just humiliating. Anyway, so I'm getting it back, and I'm down in Wayne Motor Vehicle, and I tried to get it back by every means. I didn't want to do what they want you to do, all this stuff, and it's like inconvenient. A lot of paperwork, and you're going to AA meetings, and, you know, all this outpatient. They wanted all this crap. And so I cheated, they caught me every single time. Finally, I had to do everything they asked me to do. And I go back to Wayne Motor Vehicle as indignant as you can be. But I don't do well with crowds and bright fluorescent lights and authority. You know what I mean? So a couple of drinks really loosens me up for stuff like that. I used to have to get drunk to go to traffic court, you know? So that was me. So I start drinking vodka at 9 in the morning, get to the motor vehicle, and finally I sit down in front of this woman at this desk, and I'm indignant. I'm going, I got this, and I got this signed, and this is notarized, and here's my cards. Now, give me my piece of paper so I can get my license back. And she looks at me, and she leans forward, and she starts sniffing me. She goes, "You smell like vodka. You're getting your license back from a third DWI and you're drinking? Did you drive here?" I mean, she's horrified. She's horrified. But she has to give me the piece of paper, right? I mean, it's legally she has. So she hands me this slip that I go downstairs and I get my license back, and she won't let go. It's like a tug of war. She's trying to protect humanity from me. Now listen, I'm a smart guy, okay? Why would I get drunk to go to motor vehicle to get my license back for a third DWI? That's about the stupidest thing you could possibly do. I didn't have any, where alcohol was concerned, I was strangely insane. So what is it? What is going to relieve me of this obsession to drink? The book Alcoholics Anonymous promises in the 10th step that the problem will be removed. You will be safe and protected from alcohol. You won't be fighting it. You'll be placed in a position of neutrality. Concerns alcoholism, and I'll throw drugs in there. Same thing. If you back away from the alcohol as if it's a hot flame, you have a defense against the first drink. Wouldn't that be reasonable to say? What gets you there? What gets you to that place where you have that defense? Or I won't say you have that defense. The defense is operative in you. The defense is acting through you. Obviously, if it's at the 10th step that it's a promise, do everything from step 2 through step 9, and you're going to be placed in that position of neutrality. This is what the book is stating. Did anybody ever tell you when you came into AA, if you go to enough meetings, you won't drink? Okay? I'm not saying that going to a lot of meetings is not a good thing. Bill Wilson used to say it like this: the good is sometimes the enemy of the best. If somebody tells you, look, just keep coming back, just go to meetings, tell you what, do a 90-90. That's good. Okay? The good can sometimes be the enemy of the best. Because what I'd rather hear is, get consistent with meetings, start working with a sponsor through the steps, and then get to a point where you're helping other alcoholics through the steps, carrying the message to other alcoholics. That's the best. So sometimes the good is the enemy of the best. Just don't take the first drink no matter what, even if your ass falls off. Have you heard that? I don't know about anybody in here, but 2 weeks prior to my ass falling off, I'm drinking. Okay? I am not going through the falling off ass thing without a little bit of load on. It's just me. It's just the way I am. You know what I mean? So that's good. You know, don't drink no matter what. If you have the power, at certain times you're going to be able to say no to the first drink. But the book says at certain times you're not. So the good can sometimes be the enemy of the best. There's been some controversy in some of the local meetings around here. A couple people, not about 3 weeks ago, shared some of their experience on the steps and some of their recovery experience, and they were slammed. They were slammed pretty hard by an elder in the group who had a lot of time, basically saying that, you know, if you even get started on the steps in your first year, you know, we would have just laughed at you back in the day. Now, that's an individual who probably doesn't know better. Their experience was not getting involved with the steps early on. They didn't get involved in the steps early on. So they think that you don't need to. The problem is there's a lot of people that need to get involved in the steps very, very quickly. Okay? You can only give what you have, and you give what you have. So if your experience is such that I've never done the steps, it's not unusual that you're going to say, I don't know what you're getting involved in all this stuff for. I didn't have to do that. But the fact of the matter is there's scales in alcoholism. This is the treatment for really, really serious alcoholism right here. This is the treatment, the 12-step process. Make no mistake about it. I don't think you can get involved in it too soon. I think that you can screw up, and you can miss some things, and you can rush through it, not being fearless and not being thorough and not really paying attention, yes. But if you've got a really good sponsor, somebody with a lot of experience, and they're helping you out and they're making sure you don't miss anything, I think you can get through it. Here's the thing. If you were heading into an emergency room, you've just been involved in a really bad accident, you're heading into the emergency room, and somebody's at the door waving their hand saying, you don't need to go into that emergency room. When I had my car accident, I didn't even start with emergency, I didn't even start with surgery for a year. I mean, wouldn't you move that person away from the door and get the hell in there? So if somebody is doing that to you with the step process, no, you don't have to get involved in the steps. Please, you know, you need to get your brains out of hock before you start working on that stuff. You got to move them away from the door. You know what I mean? You have to find somebody that's going to help you. This is life and death. A lot of people die from this. We buried a ton of people in our home group area around Basking Ridge and Burnsville in the last couple of years. A ton of them. The last guy we found who used to come to this meeting, he'd been 2 weeks in his apartment, dead, before they found him, before the neighbors started going, what the hell's that smell? You know what I mean? I don't want to go out like that. I don't know about anybody in here. That's not how I want to check out. I want to check out having people doing for me. I want Mary Beth to be all over the place helping me out with stuff, you know? Doing the whole number with lots of visitors. That's how I want to go out. Anyway, a power greater than ourselves can restore us to sanity. The directions for getting a hold of that power, having that power manifest in you, is in this book. And it's in the first 9 steps of this book. Now, here's the thing. Here's the funny thing. You can be an atheist. You can be an agnostic. Just do what it says in here. You can start the 3rd step prayer like this. God, I don't believe you exist. It's a line of crap, all this stuff about God. I don't believe it. You're not fooling me 1 minute. I know none of this stuff is true. I offer myself to thee, to build with thee. Do as me as thou wilt. Do you understand? Do you understand? The stuff works. It doesn't matter what you know or what you believe. It just doesn't. We don't care what you think. We care more about where your feet are going than where your head is in AA. We just do, because we know it's what you do that's going to bring you to recovery, not what you think, not what you know. It's what you do. That is a problem for people burdened with minds. You know what I'm saying? That's a problem for a lot of us that want the intellectual solution to everything. If you insist on the intellectual solution to alcoholism, you're like the person on the Titanic who is not going to get in the lifeboat until he finds out who the hell was in charge of searching for the icebergs. You know what I mean? I want to know who was on watch. I want to know whose fault it was. I want to know what kind of safety program you had about this iceberg thing. I ain't going anywhere till I find out. You're going down. Who cares? Who cares? Get on the lifeboat. The lifeboat is consistent meanings and it's the steps. Get on the goddamn lifeboat. You know what I mean? The third step, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. Again, this is a decision only. A lot of people believe doing the third step prayer is doing the third step, you know, turning their will and their life over to the care of God. Turning your will and your life over to the care of God is steps 4 through 12. That's how you turn your will and your life over to the care of God. You make a decision in step 3. And by the time you say the prayer, you've already made the decision. The prayer is an affirmation prayer. God, I offer myself to thee. You've already made the decision to turn your will and your life over to God, usually by the time you say that prayer. The other things that have to do with the third step are you're to engage in some relationship ideals as far as God is concerned, or the spirit of the universe, or however you choose to believe in God. I'm kind of a panentheist. You know, I find a lot of comfort in Christian tradition, but I also have like a metaphysical Buddhist kind of thing going on. I've got a very complicated perspective on God and what God is and what He isn't and how undefinable it all is. I've got this real complicated thing going on. All I need to know is the power is there. I can tap into the power. It's like the light switch. It's like you turn on the light switch. Do you know where those electrons are coming from that's going through the wires? No. You just know that the light is going to go on. Same thing. Prayer and meditation. I know it's turning the light switch on. I know I'm going to get to the power. Working with other alcoholics, doing amends, doing fifth steps, that's all turning on the switch. I know I'm going to get the power. I don't need to define every attribute of God. I don't have to get that involved in it. You know what I mean? Insisting on all that knowledge is, I'll tell another story. You're working in a parachute factory, okay? And it's the worst parachute factory in the world. You're on the assembly line and the biggest knuckleheads in the world are working with you. There's not one of those parachutes that's ever going to work. You know, it's Acme Parachute Company. You just know because you see them being put together. There's no friggin' way. All right? You're on vacation down in Bermuda or something, and you take one of those small puddle jumper planes from one island to the other. All of a sudden, the engine starts conking out. The pilot looks at you and says, "Oh my God, the engine's about to stall. There's a parachute under the seat. Put it on. We're going to have to bail." And you reach under the seat and you pull it out. Sure enough, it's a goddamn Acme parachute. You know Mo, Manny, and Jack put this thing together, and it's not going to work, right? Well, what are you going to do? Are you going to put it on and jump and pull the ripcord, or are you going to go down with the plane? There's a small chance that this thing might open, isn't there? So you put it on, you jump, and you pull the ripcord. And you know what? The goddamn thing opens. That's the same thing that happens to us when we make a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understand Him. We only think there's a really small chance because my problems are real. I don't know about your problems. I've got real problems. How's God going to help me with the loan sharks? Is God going to give me back my family? You know, who's going to be driving me around for the next 30 years because of my DWIs? How's God going to help me with that? I mean, but the fact of the matter is, spiritual living is the solution to alcoholism and our other problems. Spiritual living. Alcoholism is our problem. Spiritual living is the solution to those problems. So we make a decision. Are we in or are we out? Are we going to try to live our lives spiritually, or are we going to go on to the bitter end, blocking out of our consciousness the intolerable crap that's going on in our lives?
all the relationship problems, and you know how we are. We're like difficult. You know what I mean? Are we just going to plow ahead? You know, maybe they'll write a folk song about us, you know, like, he never gave in, he never listened to anybody, you know, and he ended up dying, and, you know, he's a real hero. Maybe they'll write, most likely they'll write a folk song that says he's a jerk, he's an asshole. But, because we've got it wrong, you know. But anyway, we make that decision, and we engage in spiritual living. That's all I have for tonight. We've got about 15 minutes for general sharing, critiquing, rebutting, anything. Melissa.
Hi, my name is Melissa. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey,
gee, I'm not crying, but you know, I really enjoyed what you had to your wisdom and knowledge you had to share. I heard a lot of things. I was relieved when you got to the 10th step that you said about the, because I'm very new, I only have 2 days, and I was relieved to hear that the magic that happened, you know, that was a relief, you know, because I was listening to you and I was thinking, this is not well, this is not good, and this is true, and I didn't realize that I didn't accept a lot of things until I heard what you had to say, which was very much meant to be. By the way, and I didn't realize it's been a lot easier for me to hear. I don't know why, but I started hearing, you know, and because you can listen all you want and not always hear. And I'm, you know, really glad that you shared, and I'm really glad that I came tonight. Thanks for coming
to the show. Thank you, and thanks for volunteering for the coffee commitment too. Appreciate that. Yeah, in the back. That's a very good question. Usually, when people talk about it like it's a spiritual tug of war back and forth, my understanding is that they don't understand the concept as it's laid out in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. Will and life. Your will is your thinking. Let's look at it that way. And your life is your actions. So you're turning your thinking and your actions over to God. You're making the decision to. How do you do that? You engage in the spiritual process, the spiritual exercises of the steps. But there are other areas in the book, especially in step 6 and step 7, that let you know that you are going to have defects of character. There are things that are going to hold, you're going to hold on to. There are things that are going to take a long time to overcome as far as character defects and things like that are concerned. So we can move into the recovery process by engaging in the steps. The fourth step, looking at our part in the problems in our life. Talking about them, becoming willing to have those removed. All of that is a process we can participate in. If someone is, you know, today I've got God's will going on, tomorrow I don't, I'm not really sure that they understand the step process the way it's laid out in the book. And again, if you go to step meetings, if you go to a lot of step meetings, I went to a million of them early on because I really thought by going to 12 and 12 meetings, I would learn how to do the steps. I found that quite the opposite, actually. I found a lot of people debating the steps, philosophizing about the steps, sharing about the steps, giving opinions about the steps, and there weren't a lot of people that had direct experience with the steps or were sharing their experience with the steps. It was more like a share session on the step. Yeah. And that really was not the place where I learned how to go through the steps. Anybody else? Jerry. I think at its simplest, how do you know when you've taken the third step and you've made that decision and it's a meaningful decision? You're writing inventory. And you maintain momentum through the step process and get to the other side of amends. If you balk somewhere in that process or take some time off, you know, take like 3 months off to work on your character defects or something, I did that. That was fun. Have you ever seen those games where a clown's head will come up and you'll hit it with a hammer and another head will come up somewhere else? I mean, that's what me dealing with my character defects was like. Or one of those clowns that you punch and it comes right back up. I did that. I worked on my character defects. I think there's a reason why it's two short paragraphs. I think they're telling us we don't got a lot of power with character defects. But anyway, I digress. If you've gotten to the other side of amends, you've made that decision. If you seek through prayer and meditation and you work with others, you've seriously made that decision to turn your will and your life over to the care of God. I've done that. Before I turned my will and my life over to God, or attempted to do so, I would have thought that it would have had to do with airports and selling flowers and, you know, some other things than what it is today. It's a lot different than I would have thought. But I truly believe that I'm living life along spiritual principles, and it's kind of comic if God wants me doing what I'm doing today. Yeah, He does have a sense of humor. But I just want to be open to the spiritual life. Karen.
Down a lot. So that's one indication.
and a promise. Step one is almost a reflection in the code of it. This action of actually getting on my knees, I was very fortunate early on that my instructor at least instilled 1, 2, 3, 11 years ago when I first started coming around.
My name is Bob, an alcoholic. Thank you very much, Chris, for sharing about the personal steps in front of me. You talked about unmanageability. And over the years, I've been around AA for a long, long time, 28 years, but currently sober 3 years. Thank God that I've been taken through this process. Hopefully we'll be allowed to continue to take others through it. But the unmanageability, I've shown and taught and watched others look outside of themselves to try to define the unmanageability of their lives, the spiritual void that we seem to suffer from when we're not drinking, we're not using drugs. And, you know, I had always thought it was the DWIs, the going to prison, the divorce, the... You know, getting fired from jobs, not being able to pay bills, getting thrown out of apartments, drunk, stuff, outside of me. All results of my drinking and my drug use, of course, but going through this process and being pointed to places in this book, like in the doctor's opinion, where it mentions that when I don't have a drink or a drug in my body, I'm restless and irritable and discontented until I can once again get that sense of ease and comfort. Or page 52, you know, where when I'm not drinking, when I'm not using drugs, and I don't have that old solution anymore, I have the problems. My perception of my relationships is way out of whack. And getting shown the difference of looking within rather than looking outside of me for how my life is unmanageable, how I cannot move through life successfully without harming other people, without harming myself, was a big, big, big difference for me. And, you know, really looking outside of the drama, things that happen, looking within, and using the examples in the book, the Four Horsemen is another great one, you know. Thank you.
Thanks. Yes, in the back. Scared. Great question. Great question. I'll tell you that I did it both ways. Early on in my sobriety, I just kind of assumed the first three steps and went right into inventory, and I think that's a mistake. I think that each time I need to reassess my alcoholism. I need to reassess my relationship with alcohol and the consequences. Then I have to reassess my willingness. How much of a buy-in do I have to the spiritual theory? So today, and when I take other people through the work, a lot of times, most of the people who come to me that want to go through the steps today are people who've been through it before. They want a different experience or whatever. And I'll always start with first step exercises. And sometimes that annoys them because they think they, you know I'm an alcoholic. Well, I want you to really know you're an alcoholic. I want you to go to the deepest possible understanding of your powerlessness that's possible, especially if you've been sober for a lot of years. I want you to get back to the understanding that alcoholism can still kill you. It doesn't matter that you've got 20 years separation from alcohol. It can still kill you. Let's look at that. Because a lot of times the first step is the motivation or the fuel that you use moving through the rest of the steps. So if you go right to step four, you might not have enough power to get through that amends process. Does that make any sense? Okay, we're out of time. I want to thank you all for coming tonight. Next week, Peter, I believe he's going to be talking on steps 4, 5, 6, and 7. Please come back and join us. Thanks.